Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the new Freedom to Vote Act, put together by a group of Democratic senators and Joe Manchin, who is now trying to sell it to his Republican colleagues before a vote is supposed to take place as early as next week, according to Senate Majority Leader Schumer. Joining us is Greg Pallast, a journalist who has been investigating voter suppression for decades and is the author of the New York Times and international bestsellers The Best Democracy Money Can Buy and Armed Madhouse, the recipient of the George Orwell Courage and Journalism Prize for his BBC television documentary Bush Family Fortunes. His latest book is How Trump Stole 2020, and we will discuss what is in the bill as well as what is not. Given that it is highly unlikely that Senator Manchin will win over 10 Republican senators or even one, we'll assess what the plan B might be for the Democrats, who will surely lose the 2022 and 2024 elections due to the massive and brazen nationwide Republican voter suppression campaign underway unless they get something passed, even if it does not make the electoral playing field completely level. Then we'll speak with Alfred McCoy, who holds the Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, whose latest book is In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. He joins us to discuss his article at Tom Dispatch, China, Biggest Winner in Afghanistan, A Debacle Marks the Decline of Washington's World Leadership, and how while the United States has little to show for its $2.3 trillion investment in Afghanistan, China is building infrastructure and pipelines in the region that will benefit the Taliban regime while the Chinese tap into Afghanistan's mineral wealth. Then finally, with North Korea testing two ballistic missiles on Wednesday following cruise missile tests over the weekend, and South Korea launching a ballistic missile from a submerged submarine today, we will look into what the Biden administration should be doing to avert an arms race in the region. Jessica Lee, a senior research fellow at the East Asia Program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, who researches alliances and North Korea and is the co-author of the Quincy Institute report Towards an Inclusive and Balanced Regional Order, a New U.S. Strategy for East Asia, and an article at Career on Point, Beginning of the End of Diplomacy, a case for U.S.-North Korean engagement post-IAEA report, joins us. And before we go to our first guest, now that I have resigned in protest from Pacifica and its Los Angeles station KPFK, we have moved fully to online broadcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where we will be depending upon you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program alive during the critical years ahead in which the fate of American democracy will be decided. For those of you who can, help us keep delivering a daily briefing so that those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate can also join in the fight against disinformation, whether it comes from Mar-a-Lago or Moscow. We must win the political warfare battles underway and fight with weaponized facts to save our democracy as we create a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Greg Pallast, a journalist who previously worked as a government consultant and an investigator for labor unions, the author of the New York Times and international bestsellers The Best Democracy Money Can Buy and Armed Madhouse. He is the recipient of the George Orwell Courage and Journalism Prize for his BBC television documentary Bush Family Fortunes. And his latest book is How Trump Stole 2020. Welcome to Background Briefing, Greg Pallast.
Glad to be with you again, Ian.
Thanks, Greg. And a poll by CNN has just come out finding that 93% of Americans feel that democracy in the United States is at least being tested. 56% of Americans believe that our democracy is under attack, and only 6% say that American democracy is in no danger. So what do you think of the new Freedom to Vote Act that Joe Manchin is putting forth and Senator Schumer says will be voted upon as early as next week?
Well, a couple of things. One, responding to what Americans believe, it's not just a question of belief. The secret, the dark secret of American elections, which is becoming less secret now, I've been investigating for 20 years, is that we don't let everyone vote who's a citizen and should be allowed to vote. And we don't count all the votes that are cast. And I'm not talking about messing around with voting machines. Forget all that stuff. What I'm talking about is mass in the, you know, for example, in the 12 election or the 16 election, I was able to calculate that we had about 9 million votes not counted. About 6 million people were illegally purged from the voter rolls. That means that their votes erased. And then we have something in America called spoilage, where we don't count a lot of votes. We had 2 million people cast what were called provisional ballots, like back of the bus ballots. That was mostly handed out to Black and Asian American and Hispanic voters. And those 2 million votes were never counted in 16. You have a lot of ballots that just never get counted. This has nothing to do with voting machines flipping, you know, your vote from, you know, Trump to Biden or Biden to Trump. This has to do with votes that are rejected by machines on cockamamie grounds, or absentee ballots rejected on cockamamie grounds. Like, literally, my sister is a lawyer and my mother was a school teacher, lost their ballots because they didn't properly fill in a bubble. They put an X instead of filling in a bubble next to a candidate's name. This has been a direct attack on our democracy, and it's not random. It's generally young people and especially voters of color documented it to a fare thee well. And I've been in Georgia 9 years watching this horror show, but also Georgia shows you the good side of it, which is that they can't steal all the votes all the time. Biden, Ossoff, and Warnock won, which is terrific, not because I believe that they were good candidates. I'm nonpartisan. What made the difference is that for the first time in a century in Georgia, the public actually chose their leaders. They chose their senators, not vote trickery, which is basically Jim Crow in cyberspace. As to the new bill, so that's a long answer to your first comment, but as a new bill, we should go into it, that was proposed by Joe Manchin and Amy Klobuchar, who are not exactly known as, you know, frontline voting rights advocates. But I've read through much of the bill. It's 600 pages long, which makes me different than U.S. senators who don't read this stuff. I doubt if even Manchin read his own bill. But, you know, there are definite, I'm looking at some definite real improvements. It's not wonderful. And I have a lot of objections to some of the things in there that could actually backfire. As I saw, let's not forget, we passed the Help America Vote Act in 2003, and we were told by the Congressional Black Caucus and others, this will solve all our problems with voting. Well, then how come we're here now? We had, and obviously we've had other voting rights laws which were passed, and where are we now? So if you think that this law is going to solve the problem of Jim Crow, it ain't. And the original Democratic bill didn't even come close. In fact, I'm going to tell you, honestly, this may be an improvement over the original bill when you actually look at the details. But it is, there's no substitute for going out there and fighting the mass purge of voters and fighting the mass, basically tossing away of millions of legal votes. And this doesn't take too much of a chunk out of that process. So Jim Crow is not eliminated. Just put on in a more restrictive, you know, we've taken off his tennis shoes and putting on some heavy boots, so he can't run as quickly.
Well, let me just add a couple of names to the people who put this bill together, along with Manchin and Klobuchar that you mentioned. There's also Senator Tim Kaine, Angus King, Jeff Merkley, Alex Padilla, John Tester, and Raphael Warnock. And the bill does include mandating national minimum standards for early voting and vote by mail. It establishes Election Day as a national holiday, which seems like a huge improvement to me. It has also requirements for dark money disclosure, and it also has elements of Raphael Warnock's Preventing Election Subversion Act, which will counter some of these pernicious activities going on in Texas and Georgia. And it puts in place safeguards against local election officials being removed for partisan purposes, and makes intimidating election workers a felony, which is a program that Steve Bannon has introduced and being funded by people like the Silicon Valley billionaire Peter Thiel. So the battle is on.
So, yes, so it's the only real voting rights advocate on that whole panel is Raphael Warnock, right, who is senator from Georgia, who I've known for years. I was the first person to actually put him on national TV. And a former preacher at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Dr. King's old church. And he's a true voting rights advocate, not a radical by any means, but very progressive and very thoughtful. So his, you know, his inclusion in there, I mean, there's a lot of tokenism in that, but you know, is obviously positive. But that, but I'm concerned that that his presence makes it seem like, well, this solves all our problems, and it just scratches it. So, for example, and you know, we could always pick on, and I will admit, I don't want to be one of these people that says that there's no such thing as an improvement, et cetera. But here's, you know, obviously expanding early voting is quite important. They have felon reenfranchisement. Now, this is interesting because despite what people think, almost all ex-cons in the U.S. are indeed allowed to vote. But I'm glad this bill actually says, but as a practical matter, they are blocked in many states, like Florida, where people voted a Proposition 2 to have to re-enfranchise, let people vote who have a criminal record, and that was supposed to put 1.4 million people back on the voter rolls. They put so many impediments in the way, that is the Republican state legislature, that only 200,000 of the 1.4 million ex-cons got are registered right now. You know, there's things in there, little things, like that registration forms and must allow for accent marks on names. You know, we did have people, you know, if your name was Garcia Marquez, good luck registering anywhere, including California. And when you try to show an ID, they say, well, that has an accent mark and you didn't register with an accent mark. So, I mean, it might sound small, but that's a real issue for the Hispanic community. There are things I really don't like, expanding the use of ID requirement. There is no, one of the most important things, not that the first bill did, but a shorter bill, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. This bill does not restore what's called pre-clearance that was in the original Voting Rights Act. In other words, you can't play the you're not going to be able to enforce this law without pre-clearance. So I, you know, you could have this law and I don't, it's not going to be enforceable. That's the biggest problem, because Manchin apparently would not allow the return of preclearance. What is preclearance? It's a fancy term saying that if the state is going to do something like move voting, you know, like change ID requirements, come up with a new system of purging voter rolls, you have to get it cleared by the Justice Department to make sure it's not discriminatory. This was the key thing. It was thrown out by the U.S. Supreme Court in 2013. It should have been brought back in this law, and it isn't. So enforcement of this law is going to be, well, let's put it this way. The problem we run into right now, you can enforce these laws, but they're after the elections. And we don't, in America, if an election is stolen, we don't run it again. So in other words, the thieves get away with the crime. And you say, well, next time you'll have to come up with something else to steal your election. I'm very concerned about lack of enforcement in this bill. Also, they have a whole section called Saving Eligible Voters from Voter Purging, which has been one of my big issues. I was the reporter back in 2000 that uncovered that Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush had removed 52,000 black men from the voter rolls, saying that they were felons, which at the time couldn't vote in Florida. None of them were, not a single one, but they were black. I know that because it said BLA next to their names. And that's how George Bush became president. Now, on this law would not prohibit that. This law would not prohibit this mass purging that is the biggest single impediment to voting rights in America. Not that you can't give someone a slice of pizza while they're waiting in line. Not that you deny them a ballot because of their voter ID or lack thereof. None of those things come close to the damage caused by blocking voters by simply erasing them from the voter rolls. This thing doesn't do it. It says it does and it doesn't, because for example, one of the new vote purge techniques I'm trying to find, which is now being established in Georgia, Florida, Texas, Pennsylvania, and several other states, is called ERIC. And it is a private agency, but it uses so-called official documents, that is such things as post office change of address forms, which are nonsense for determining whether someone is a resident eligible voter. And they are not blocking this purging system. They are not blocking what Chris Kobach, if you remember Chris Kobach of Kansas, the Trump's vote thief in chief, had a system called interstate cross-check. Hey, the last bill, the last big Democratic bill, literally authorized it by name. This huge racist program that challenged 7 million voters, removed a million voters. As far as I could tell, none of them were illegal voters. Did quite an investigation for Rolling Stone. None of these things are being prohibited in this law, despite this whole section called Saving Eligible Voters from Voter Purging. It doesn't do it. And in fact, it could be read by an evil judge, and we have plenty of those. And an evil right-wing judge is saying, well, it says that you can use, you know, official records to see if, quote, someone has permanently moved out of state and is no longer eligible to vote. Well, that's what the Chris Kobach Interstate Cross-Check Program did. That's what this ERIC program did. I did an analysis of the ERIC program in Wisconsin for Black Voters Matter and found out that a third of the names on there of people who had moved had not moved. I spoke to them. I filmed them in their homes. They didn't move anywhere. But almost every single person that was removed by this program was either a Black voter in Milwaukee or a student voter in Madison. Again, this does not prohibit it. In fact, it looks like it authorizes that type of vote trickery. So it has improvements. It has detriments. And there's awful lot that are missing. Awful lot.
And again, I'm speaking with Greg Palace, a journalist who previously worked as a government consultant and an investigator for labor unions, the author of the New York Times and international bestsellers The Best Democracy Money Can Buy and Armed Madhouse. He is the recipient of the George Orwell Courage and Journalism Prize for his BBC television documentary Bush Family Fortunes, and his latest book is How Trump Stole 2020. Well, Stacey Abrams initially said that she approved of Manchin's bill. I'm not sure whether she would approve of this current iteration, but it's going before, as I mentioned earlier, Senator Schumer thinks they could even vote on this as early as next week. But Manchin's trying to get 10 Republicans to join him. That's never going to happen. Even Susan Collins is backing away from it. So there has to be a plan B, surely, Greg, because otherwise, why are they doing this? And Manchin can't be completely delusional, thinking that 10 Republicans will vote for it. He won't get any Republicans to vote for it. So he must have a plan B.
Yeah, I think that he won't get any Republicans. It's not clear. I mean, Murkowski, well, who's not a Republican, who sits with that caucus, has made noises about, for example, actually supporting the John Lewis Act, which would actually be better than this whole 600-page halfway bill. But, look, I used to work in state legislatures and Congress, and it's an old trick. You pretend you're doing something, but you know it won't actually come up for a vote, or it will, you know, it won't be implemented into law. And, it's an old trick by politicians. In fact, one of the reasons why the Family Leave Act passed when Bill Clinton, allows you to take off time for a new kid or family medical emergency. The only reason that passed, it's an interesting story about how legislation works, is that under Bush Sr. as president, it passed overwhelmingly in the Senate and House because everyone was for allowing people to take time off. But Republicans really, really didn't want that bill, and a lot of conservative corporate Democrats didn't want that bill because it's going to cost industry money. But they thought, well, Bush was going to veto it, so who cares? Clinton came in and brilliantly, instead of people told him to improve the law, he said, no, they voted for this already. Don't change a comma, so they can't change their vote. And literally in his about 10 days into office, Bill Clinton passed the only important act of the only positive progressive act of his entire 8 years. Was within 10 days of office because he didn't change it. In other words, people were voting for that bill as virtue signaling, but they didn't actually have to do it and piss off their corporate donors. You're not going to. So this is a good way for Manchin to say, and the right wing Democrats to say, we're doing the right thing. We want to do the right thing, but golly, those Republicans just won't join us. And Manchin has said something this important like voting has to be bipartisan. Yeah,
but Greg, just in the last minute, though, what would the next step be? I mean, obviously reconciliation is the way to go, but you got to get work around the filibuster. So Manchin must be prepared to do something, surely. Otherwise, why go through this exercise? And why have Schumer say they're going to vote on it?
Well, because Schumer wants to say, we'll vote on it so that the Democratic constituents will say, you can go to back to your constituents and say, well, I tried, I voted for it, but we couldn't get any Republicans. Manchin will say, I tried, but I couldn't get any Republicans. I'm sorry. You know, shame on them. And everyone will go home happy.
No, they won't, because the Democrats will lose the 2022 election and the 2024 elections under the current circumstances. So it's existential for them. They have to do something.
You know, this is a very, you know, remember, until Stacey Abrams came along, I was constantly being told by the Democratic Party to shut up about vote suppression. They say, you're discouraging people from voting. Don't bring up vote suppression. You know, you can't bring this up. And I couldn't get editors. They say, you know, you're attacking basically American democracy by saying it's difficult to vote. So to even get Democrats to talk about the issue, that's already a giant improvement. To get them to do something about it, well, that's going to take another decade, I think.
Well, we'll have one party rule in 2 years. So
yes, you know, look, I wrote that book, How Trump Stole 2020. And people say, oh, you had it wrong. I was 44,000 votes off. And that's because millions of votes were not counted, were rejected. As I say, absentee ballots, 2 million provisional ballots, almost all minority ballots. We had at least 4 million people illegally purged from the voter rolls. And I actually want a federal suit in Georgia on this. And if it weren't for that, for the our win in that federal suit, Ossoff, Warnock, and Biden would not be there. Okay? They wouldn't have won Georgia. So I don't count on the Democratic Party to do this. It's going to be the activists, the voting rights activists in the streets, voting rights activists in the courtrooms and in the churches. That's how it's done. I don't count on the Democratic Party to save our votes. They are incumbents, and there's one party ultimately, and it's the party of incumbency. And they ain't going to change the rules, which will also make it harder for them to win their primaries.
Well, Greg Palast, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Greg Palast, who's a journalist who previously worked as a government consultant and an investigator for labor unions, the author of the New York Times and international bestsellers, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy and Armed Madhouse. He is the recipient of the George Orwell Courage and Journalism Prize for his BBC television documentary, Bush Family Fortunes. And his latest book is How Trump Stole 2020. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into why the U.S. has little to show for its $2.3 trillion investment in Afghanistan. China is building infrastructure and pipelines in the region that will benefit the Taliban regime while the Chinese tap into Afghanistan's mineral wealth. I'll give you power over me. I'll give you power. Now I gotta be free. I'll give you power. Now I say, I give you power. I can take it away. I can take it away. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Alfred McCoy, who holds a Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the author of Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. His latest book is In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. And he has an article at Tom Dispatch, China Biggest Winner in Afghanistan, a debacle marks the decline of Washington's world leadership. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alfred McCoy.
Ian, good to hear from you again.
Well, thanks, Alan. And you don't think that there's any sort of buyer's remorse going on with Pakistan and perhaps to a lesser extent China, in the sense that already we don't even know whether Mullah Baradar, who did the negotiations in Doha that led to the deal that both Trump and then later Biden inherited, which enabled this victory on the part of the Taliban. Apparently, there was a huge brawl in the palace in Kabul between the Haqqani people and the other more radical members of the Taliban leadership, who feel that they won the war through military means, whereas Baradar arguing, no, we won diplomacy. Now Baradar has gone missing, as has the supposed head of the Taliban, and he's also missing as well. So at this point, one wonders what exactly this victory is all about.
Yeah, internally, it is a revolutionary movement, and there's always, in the aftermath of revolution, a process of infighting and consolidation. You know, the American enemy that united them, the goal that they all fought for, has now been captured. The American enemy is gone, and there's a settling of accounts. And sometimes that's quick and easy, and sometimes it can be incredibly brutal, almost like a self-evisceration, if not a suicide. So yes, that's going to go on. That's a part of every revolutionary struggle. But then, you know, in the fullness of time, power gets consolidated, and once it does, Afghanistan will be integrated into Beijing's Belt and Road Initiative. It's BRI. It's Massive Infrastructure Scheme for integrating the whole of Eurasia into a single market, a single infrastructure for the production and delivery of raw materials to China.
Well, for the longest time, of course, in this long and agonizing and fruitless 20-year engagement of the U.S. in Afghanistan, everything had to go through Pakistan because Afghanistan is landlocked. And the Indians built a road from the Indian Ocean at an Iranian port all the way up to Herat. And the U.S. could never take advantage of that because of its relationship or lack of a relationship with Iran. So tell us about how you see the Chinese doing a kind of squeeze play on Afghanistan, this landlocked country.
Well, first of all, more broadly, in 2013, President Xi Jinping of China went to Nazarbayev University in Kazakhstan, and he proclaimed the Belt and Road Initiative to unify the whole of Eurasia from the Baltic Sea to the South China Sea in the world's greatest market. And indeed, Eurasia is home to 70% of the world's population and productivity. You know, it is the epicenter of global politics. As he knows well, every major global power over the last 500 years that has purported to dominate the globe has done so by the dominance of the Eurasian landmass, starting with Portugal, the Dutch, the British, and indeed us, the Americans. During our heyday, we controlled Eurasia by controlling the axial ends of Eurasia through the NATO alliance in the West, and then four bilateral military treaties with Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Australia in the East. And now China is developing an overland strategy, laying down a massive infrastructure across the Eurasian landmass to integrate it. And that infrastructure project, as a part of it, basically boxed Afghanistan in the years and months preceding the U.S. withdrawal. About 10 years ago, China began building a massive series of natural gas pipelines from Central Asia to China to meet China's voracious appetite for fossil fuels. They then, starting in 2015, they began construction of a $46 billion integrated transport corridor from western China down to the port of Gwadar in Pakistan on the Arabian Sea, which had been transformed from literally a fishing village into a truly modern port through Chinese investment. It's now a dual-use facility. It's a Pakistan and a Chinese naval base. The Chinese have visiting rights. And then just in March, China broke through the blockade that the United States has tried to put on Iran by signing a $400 billion development deal that, among other things, is going to build a Istanbul to Islamabad railroad with Tehran as its hub. And when you think about it, okay, from the north, the pipelines, and the west, Iran, with this $400 billion deal, in the east, Pakistan, with a very close Chinese-Pakistan alliance embodied in that $46 billion quarter. And lying right in the center was Afghanistan, just waiting to fall into China's grasp without firing a shot. And so it was. In July of this year, you know, when the United States was sort of conducting its withdrawal, the man you mentioned, Mullah Baradar, headed a delegation that went to Beijing and met with the Chinese foreign minister. And the Chinese foreign minister hailed the Taliban as a positive force. The Taliban expressly promised to create an environment that was sympathetic to Chinese investment. And then they went behind closed doors where Baradar sat down with the Chinese foreign minister. We don't know what it was. They said it was a, you know, one of those free and frank discussions on matters of mutual interest, i.e., who gets what for how much. So the deal was done. And then, you know, during our withdrawal from Afghanistan, the United States was desperate for some kind of regional base to operate, to get a base for landing aircraft, to get bases for continuing counter-terror operations. And we found that right throughout the region, all those Central Asian states that have once been cooperative with us, who once had air bases in Central Asia, they froze us out. You know, we were literally frozen out of the region. So that's why we all talk about this over-the-horizon capacity. We now have to deal with Afghanistan from our bases in the Persian Gulf, which is a 2,000-mile round-trip flight. In terms of real operational capacity, we've lost completely. We've been squeezed out. And what's the prize? Well, for years now, geologists have been telling us that Afghanistan is sitting on $1 trillion of minerals, including rare earth minerals, which are critical for the lithium batteries and the battery storage that's going to be critical for our conversion from fossil fuels for electricity to solar power and wind power for electricity, because you have to have storage capacity. So Afghanistan is a great prize. Already, there's a Turkmenistan, Afghanistan-Pakistan pipeline that's under construction, that's going to pass right through Afghanistan, providing the new regime with royalties on transit of natural gas to feed Pakistan's voracious appetite for fossil fuels. It doesn't have any natural sources. And so, in effect, you know, if you look at the geopolitics, we were being squeezed out of Afghanistan. We were losing our operational capacity before we pulled out. And now that we've pulled out, Afghanistan is just ready to fall into China's grasp. And what's the consequence of that? Well, it means we've lost any kind of position in Central Asia, which in geopolitical terms is kind of the pivot for the control of the Eurasian landmass. And that increases and improves China's position in that landmass. And if China can dominate the Eurasian landmass, they can then earn a position to dominate 70% of the world's population and productivity. In short, become the world's preeminent global power, supplanting the United States.
And again, I'm speaking with Alfred McCoy, who holds the Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. And his latest book is In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. And he has an article at Tom Dispatch, China, Biggest Winner in Afghanistan, A Debacle Marks the Decline of Washington's World Leadership. So this is an extraordinary picture that you've painted, and it's very real. And the Chinese are literally building real stuff, the Belt and Road. That's all real. What have we built? We spent $2.3 trillion in Afghanistan. All it did was perpetuate the military-industrial complex's grip over American politics and over the treasury. A lot of that equipment, was left behind. Is this emblematic of the problem that we have? We spend more on the military than the next 11 states below us in the food chain. And what have we got to show for it?
Well, in Afghanistan, precious little. If you look at pictures of Afghanistan and take Kabul, you know, which is basically a city of rubble and low-rise buildings in 2001, and you now look at the kind of shimmering curtain glass skyscrapers that line the city's skyline today, and that's where our money went. Now, this is an impoverished economy with no capacity really to build anything, and that $1 trillion that we pumped into Afghanistan for military and for development basically put the people of Afghanistan, particularly the purported 300,000 soldiers in the Afghan army, as kind of welfare recipients, and then their leaders skimmed off all the money. and built those glorious buildings. So no, we wasted it. Moreover, the comparison with Saigon has been much in the air of late. The Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said this is not Saigon. President Biden told us last July that there was no comparison with Saigon. Americans would not be pulled off the embassy roof on helicopters. Well, it actually is like Saigon, except it's much worse. Because in the downfall of South Vietnam in 1975, the North Vietnamese army was grinding down the highway towards Saigon, and they ran into an ordinary South Vietnamese unit called the 18th Division. And that 18th Division fought the North Vietnamese to a standstill for 2 full weeks. They lost 30% of their men in casualties. And in the end, the North Vietnamese, in order to capture Saigon, simply had to go around the 18th Division. And when Saigon fell, 5 South Vietnamese generals sitting at their desk took out their service revolvers and shot themselves in the head. They committed suicide in remorse over their failure of their patriotic commitment to their nation. There was nothing like that. In Afghanistan, the commanders didn't take a bullet. They took the cash from the Taliban to turn over all of their arms, equipment, and to send their men home. So by the Taliban rolled into Kabul, and you've seen the photographs here, I'm sure, they look like a NATO army. You know, Kevlar helmets, body armor, driving Humvees, right? They started out, they had, AK-47, Kalashnikov rifles, and tennis sneakers. And that transformation was due to this systematic corruption and payoff. So the U.S. capacity for building up states, for nation building, has really diminished significantly since the fall of Saigon in 1975.
Well, but we're recycling money back to the military-industrial complex. Isn't that the bottom line here? I mean, the comparisons, and you make this clear in your article, Al, that President Tu in South Vietnam, remember he limped out of the palace onto a plane because there were so much gold bars in his entourage that they could barely carry the bags. And similarly, Ashraf Ghani disappears to the UAE with apparently $169 million in U.S. currency.
Oh, the leaders we picked are a testament to our diplomatic incompetence in these areas. I mean, Win Van Thieu and Ashraf Ghani were our hand-picked leaders. They were both equally corrupt, equally incompetent. But I think the test in the diminished U.S. international capacity came lower down, because in South Vietnam, the U.S. was such a preeminent power, and our sense of democracy and development under American leadership as the way forward was convincing enough for the South Vietnamese that to infuse that state, at least among the military, the civil servants, and much of the middle class, with a deep sense of nationalism, which is evident very much in the Vietnamese exile community in the United States. Men and women of that generation are intensely loyal to South Vietnam. Okay? So we did that. That in a certain sense, it succeeded. It was a tribute, even in our failure, to the extent of our influence. All right? Today was an absolute failure. The ultimate test of nationalism is the willingness of citizens to fight and die for a nation. And clearly, the state we constructed in Afghanistan could not command a scintilla of loyalty from the Afghan military. And let's be clear about this, okay? This is not something to do with the ordinary Afghan farmer. Over the past 200 years, history has established that arguably the finest fighters in the entire world are Afghan farmers, ordinary farm boys in Afghanistan. As you know, in 1832, they slaughtered 16,000 British troops. More recently, in the 1980s, they inflicted tremendous damage and huge casualties upon the Soviet Red Army, which was then at the peak of its Cold War power. And they fought us to a standstill, and they, of course, recently defeated our client army. So now these are some of the world's finest fighters. The question is, why wouldn't they fight for Ashraf Ghani and this made-up American state in Kabul? And it's because, I think, of our failure and the diminution, the weakening of America's aura as a world leader. We're no longer terribly convincing when we propose one of these nation-building projects.
So just in the last couple of minutes there now, obviously the minute we stopped fighting in Vietnam, and we were after all, there's a similarity in the sense that the Vietnamese, at least the North Vietnamese, were fighting against foreign invaders as they saw it. There's no question that the glue that holds the Taliban together is fighting foreign occupiers. But the minute we left, we lost Vietnam, the new Vietnamese, North Vietnamese government were, you know, rattling the tin cup, wanting help. And now it's a very prosperous capitalist country with deep ties to the United States. And in terms of Afghanistan, they're in a desperate shape. There could be widespread starvation, and most of their money is held abroad, and the U.S. and other donor nations are holding back. And it looks as if both China and Pakistan are pretty much on the hook. So what kind of leverage do we still have, and how should we use it?
Yeah, you know, the U.S. position in Eurasia has diminished. Look, back in the 1970s, when we lost Vietnam, there were also two parallel bros to U.S. foreign policy. One, you know, Japan and Germany, through their massive exports, had created a huge balance of payments problem for the United States. So the Bretton Woods system for managing the global economy that was established at the end of World War II at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, 1944, basically had to come to an end. The United States unilaterally ended the convertibility of the dollar to gold. All right. And that was one sign of our weakening. Moreover, instead of us setting that rate, it would now be henceforth set by international markets. So we lost that kind of economic control. The other thing that happened was that while we were absorbed in fighting this low-tech war in Vietnam from 1962 to 1973, the Soviets were building hundreds of missiles. And so they forced us to sign the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty. They didn't force us, but circumstances compelled us to do so. And that de facto recognized the Soviet Union as an equal nuclear power. And the two fundamental bases of U.S. post-war power was the almighty dollar and nuclear power. And suddenly those were diminished. So we stepped back a notch. No longer were we the world's great global hegemon, all right? We were now just a world leader. And what we're seeing now in Afghanistan, that even that world leadership has now been fundamentally challenged and diminished by this withdrawal. Not only did the collapse of the Afghan military and state show our weakness as a nation-building power, something we've always had, but it also showed China was able, without a shot fired, without a penny lost, without a one drop of blood, just lets this great prize, the resources of Afghanistan, its geopolitical location, fall into its grasp. And so they've gained everything with the expenditure of nothing. And we spent $2 trillion and wound up with nothing at all, except a loss of prestige and power. So this is a much more portentous, a much more serious blow than Saigon was. And it's a harbinger, I feel. It's a bellwether for really the decline of U.S. global influence.
Well, Alfred McCoy, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Ian, thanks for the chat.
And again, I've been speaking with Alfred McCoy, who holds a Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. And his latest book is In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. And he has an article at Tom Dispatch, China Biggest Winner in Afghanistan, A Debacle Marks the Decline of Washington's World Leadership. I'm going to take a brief station break and back looking into North Korea's testing of two ballistic missiles on Wednesday following cruise missile tests over the weekend and South Korea's launching of a ballistic missile from a submerged submarine today.
I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to start a flame in your heart. In my heart, I have...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jessica Lee, who's a senior research fellow in the East Asia program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, whose research interests include U.S. foreign policy towards the Indo-Pacific region, with an emphasis on alliances and North Korea. A non-resident senior associate fellow at the Asia-Pacific Leadership Network and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, she has testified before the House Committee on Foreign Affairs as Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission and co-authored the Quincy Institute's report Towards an Inclusive and Balanced Regional Order, a New U.S. Strategy in East Asia. And she has an article at Korea on Point, Beginning of the End of Diplomacy, a Case for U.S.-North Korea Engagement Post-IAEA Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jessica Lee.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And there have been a series of missile tests starting on the weekend. North Korea launched cruise missile tests. And then on Wednesday, they fired two ballistic missiles. And then shortly thereafter, the South Koreans fired a ballistic missile launched from a submarine under the water, a submarine-launched ballistic missile from a submerged 3,700-ton submarine. Of course, since South Korea isn't a nuclear power, it wasn't a missile that would carry a nuclear warhead, but South Korea doesn't have nuclear warheads, but North Korea does. And there's the problem, right? And North Korea's been increasing its arsenal, has it not?
That's exactly right. I think today's ballistic missile test by North Korea and the submarine-launched ballistic missile test by South Korea underscores the stark reality, you know, that we need diplomacy and we need dialogue and negotiations as soon as possible. You know, this ratcheting of pressure on the part of Pyongyang is in some ways a very predictable response to last month's U.S.-South Korea joint military exercise, which North Korean government condemned and called it, you know, a hostile activity. But this latest development, I think, explains why North Korea needs to be a higher priority of the Biden administration, one that merits fresh thinking on off-ramps, de-escalation, incentives, and a more pragmatic, slow-building process forward rather than maximalist demands. I just, you know, think it's also important for us to keep in mind that, you know, some analysts in Washington who work on North Korea will tell you that, you know, United States has done nothing wrong and that everything that has led us to this point of a dangerous arms race between the Koreas is, you know, Kim Jong-un regime's fault. And I think the reality here is much more complex. You know, I think part of what we need to do is, you know, really reckon with the fact that American policies of, you know, maximum pressure and our inability to fulfill past agreements have contributed, you know, to the militarization of the Korean Peninsula as we see today. And I also think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, as the Biden administration completed its North Korea policy, it has not offered any details about what its strategy to North Korea would be. And it also hasn't proposed any new confidence-building measures that could lead to, you know, a resumption in talks. And so without a clear strategy and without sort of the on-ramps to get back to negotiations, I'm not sure what we can expect other than more escalatory measures like we're seeing today.
So South Korea's President Moon met with China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi in Seoul just at the same time as these Wednesday tests took place. So what would the significance of that in terms of the timing be?
That's exactly right. I mean, I think the idea is China and South Korea are talking and trying to figure out a way forward. But, you know, we also see a lot of the diplomacy led by the U.S. Special Representative for North Korea Policy, Sung Kim, with respect to his counterparts in Japan and South Korea, all of which I think are incredibly important and should continue. But the problem is we are having countries sort of talk past each other and talk in small groups, when really this is a big enough of an issue where all the regional stakeholders, I think, including Russia, should be at the table. Now, you know, how we get there in sort of this political climate, especially in Washington, where we tend to see countries like China and Russia through a very ideological zero-sum lens, you know, it's going to be very difficult. But at the same time, when you have countries that are sort of, you know, talking in smaller groups, and especially, you know, in a trilateral fashion, you know, which is something the Biden administration is really focused on with respect to its allies, South Korea and Japan, you know, you have questions that are not being answered, you know, such as how would China, you know, consider its equities with respect to a long term, you know, peace agreement or other kind of solutions that could, you know, be, you know, ahead of us. And so I do think it's critically important to be multilateral and to be really creative in talking to all of the stakeholders and making everyone in the region feel like they are part of the solution rather than creating these small blocks, because I don't think that is going to be effective. And I think that as the Chinese and South Korean leaders are going to recognize as well, that there are still too many differences that exist between key parties of the Korean War and of the today's geopolitics. For, you know, parties to not really flesh them out, you know, simultaneously.
And again, I'm speaking with Jessica Lee, who's a senior research fellow in the East Asia program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, whose research interests has an emphasis on alliances and North Korea. And she is the co-author of the Quincy Institute's report Towards an Inclusive and Balanced Regional Order, a New U.S. Strategy in East Asia. And she has an article at Korea on Point, Beginning of the End of Diplomacy, a Case for U.S.-North Korea Engagement Post-IAEA Report. So we know that the North Koreans have revived their production of plutonium. And I don't know whether that means that they're working towards miniaturization of warheads. There's speculation that they may not have a warhead that could be on the cruise missile that was launched over the weekend and on their ballistic missiles. But that's sort of scant assurance, because North Korea continues to make enormous progress in its missile production and in its numbers of warheads. So it's also a country, of course, that is ruled by a pretty intense level of paranoia, which is being exacerbated by the COVID crisis as well. So how do you reach out to a country that needs an outside enemy? What would you recommend Biden do here? Obviously, the country is also suffering from a renewed famine, and we know that there was a famine a few years ago that was devastating. So what are the options in terms of breaking the ice? And of course, many other presidents have tried this, so there's a track record there. Maybe we can learn from that. But what's your suggestion, Jessica?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I think, you know, as you pointed out, right now we're, you know, living through a global pandemic. And, you know, there are 25 million people who live in North Korea whom, you know, some of whom may have COVID. We have no idea. The government says that there's zero COVID infected cases. And so, you know, that's, I think, the low level of visibility and knowledge that, you know, we're working against. But, you know, to your question about what can be done given this very difficult, almost intractable situation we find ourselves, you know, I do think that there is room for back channel diplomacy here. North Korea does not want to accept any humanitarian aid from the United States, including COVID vaccines, believe it or not. I think because it believes Washington will politicize it and use it as sort of leverage over the North Korean government. And so this is, of course, highly problematic. And I think if we are serious about eradicating the COVID-19 virus, we need to be really realistic about these types of political challenges. And so I think some back channel diplomacy, you know, of the U.S. using its power and influence in, you know, things like the UN and COVAX to quietly encourage these entities to offer, you know, vaccines, you know, I think could be one way to generate goodwill later on, assuming that North Korea, of course, accepts it, which is a variable to be sure. And then to your other, you know, to your broader question, I think, you know, this is something obviously that extends much beyond farther than, you know, just COVID or vaccine diplomacy. You know, what can be done to break this terrible cycle of escalation and near constant threat of war, which is what the Korean people on both sides of the 38th parallel live with, you know, as part of their geography. You know, what can be done? What are some of the long-term solutions U.S. should be advocating? And I think it starts with the reality that we have a very volatile situation on the peninsula, in part because the Korean War never formally ended. It's actually technically still ongoing. There was never a peace treaty that was signed. It's in this protracted, weird state where, you know, there is a great deal of fear and paranoia on both Koreas that the war could be reignited. you know, through some catastrophic miscalculation. So I do think as a party to the armistice, United States can encourage the closing of that war by formally declaring that war over and, you know, moving ahead with a peace treaty that would be signed by North Korea and China. That were parties to the armistice. Now, I'm under no illusion that this will be difficult, again, given sort of the high level of, you know, partisanship and the anti-China lens with which many foreign policymakers are looking at Asia. But I do think that if we want stability, which definitely serves U.S. interests far greater than getting dragged into another Korean War, that these are the types of political and diplomatic solutions that U.S. government should be pursuing diligently and not just pay lip service to various constituents here in the U.S. that, you know, have really wanted closure from that war and a more normal relationship. So, for example, Korean Americans, you know, I was part of a civic Korean American organization for 4 years. And there is a lot of issues here regarding Korean Americans with family members in North Korea that they can't contact. They have no way of knowing if they're alive. Again, because the two governments don't recognize each other, don't talk to each other. And, you know, so these are some of the practical challenges that I think could be overcome with a more pragmatic political solution rather than looking at the North Korea issue, you know, primarily as a nuclear threat.
So in May, President Moon of South Korea and U.S. President Joe Biden agreed to end a 40-year-long bilateral agreement that limited the range and payload of South Korean missiles. And we mentioned the test on today of a submarine-launched ballistic missile from a South Korean submarine. And the Europeans, by the way, are now talking about sort of getting away from the U.S. umbrella, if you will, or the U.S. domination of their security interests, and then Europeans starting to create their own security framework or expand on their NATO framework without the U.S. being the dominant player. The assumption here is that maybe, and of course there's a lot of talk about the U.S., the messy withdrawal from Afghanistan, making allies nervous that you can't trust the U.S. So if this is a trend, and whatever the interpretations are, we can, you know, other people can argue about it, but how is that going to affect things? Because the North Koreans were very unhappy about the agreement in May between Biden and Moon over allowing the South Koreans to increase their range and payload of their missiles.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very important question. And certainly, you know, given what we're seeing today in terms of, you know, what seems to be sort of an arms race between the two Koreas, you know, I think understanding South Korean, you know, foreign policy, military and defense policies, of course, will be really important. I mean, I think the interesting thing is that, you know, under the Moon administration in South Korea, there has been a constant and a very consistent message in support of diplomacy and inter-Korean cooperation. Of course, some of that has been stymied due to the ongoing, U.S.-led sanctions at the U.N. Security Council and, of course, the U.S. Legislature as well. But given that reality of, you know, the fact that we have these sanctions that prevent closer inter-Korean cooperation, I think there is still hope and desire among South Koreans to have a more predictable relationship with North Korea. Now, it is going to be difficult to do that because there right now is really little progress being made, at least as far as, you know, I can tell publicly based on public sources toward that end. And so we need to, you know, be thinking about, well, what are countries like South Korea and to some extent Japan going to do as the North Korea nuclear threat increases over time? And I think these countries will understandably seek to strengthen their own deterrence to make sure that North Korea doesn't, you know, harm them. And so this is part of, you know, I think the calculation American policymakers must understand and must make. You know, which is that our inaction and our ability, you know, lack of leadership in resolving this North Korea issue will result in more countries in the region feeling insecure and seeking to build their own nuclear deterrence against North Korea. And so this, and as you said, because of the Afghanistan withdrawal, you know, I think there is some heightened anxiety among some, you know, watchers in South Korea that, you know, perhaps U.S. resolve and the U.S. alliance is not as reliable as they once thought. But, you know, I don't think that those two things are, you know, sort of, you know, necessarily the case. I think it's possible for Americans to have a more realistic and modest footprint in the Middle East and South Asia, and also have a robust policy in Asia that doesn't really lead to nuclear escalation and some of the things we're seeing now. So right now, you know, I would say at the end of the day, what countries in the region want is stability. And I think the only way we get there is through, you know, a more modest set of expectations and on-ramps and things that will bring, you know, these parties, some of which are, you know, former enemies of war, to the negotiating table so that we don't spiral out of control.
Great. Well, Jessica Lee, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me. I'm sorry for the coughing. My apologies.
No worries.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Jessica Lee, who's a senior research fellow in the East Asia program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, whose research interests include U.S. foreign policy towards the Indo-Pacific region with an emphasis on alliances and North Korea. She is the co-author of the Quincy Institute report Towards an Inclusive and Balanced Regional Order, a New U.S. Strategy in East Asia. And she has an article at Korea on Point, Beginning of the End of Diplomacy, a Case for U.S.-North Korea Engagement Post-IAEA Report. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews, searchable by topic, and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we also encourage you to rate and review us on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. To help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all, please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. Now that I have resigned from Pacifica, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305.